Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of All Crime, No Cattle. This is episode 55, and I am your trusty Detective Shea Butter. And with me, as always, is our resident Bone Lady, and this is a Bone Lady episode. It's Erin. Hello, Erin.
Hello, long time no see.
Yeah, it's been a minute.
It has been, and if you're listening to this, it means that we are currently in Chicago for the True Crime Podcast Festival, which we're very excited about, and we hope to see some of you there.
Yeah, that's right. We're going to be right smack dab in the Windy City, and it's going to be a little extra windy because we're not bringing Gas X, and there's going to be a lot of pizza and hot dogs in our future, I'm guessing.
Oh, I hope so.
So what do you have for us today, Erin?
Well, before we begin, we really have to thank the sponsor for this episode and the person who chose this topic, our Texas Ranger, Mel T.
Woohoo!
Mel, thank you so much for your patronage. You are a sweetheart, and I hope you find this case interesting and maybe thought-provoking. I know that I did. If you're interested in supporting the show and choosing the topic of your very own episode, you can find all our info over at patreon.com/allcrimenocattle. This is the case of the murders of Jerry Dean and Deborah Thornton by Daniel Ryan Garrett and Carla Faye Tucker. This double homicide is, to this day, still considered one of the most horrific and depraved crimes in Houston's history. Chances are, none of those names I just mentioned are familiar to you except the last one, Carla Faye Tucker. And that's because while there are two victims and two murderers involved, this became the Carla Faye Tucker story, both in the media and in the ensuing debate over the legal and moral implications of the death penalty. This case sparked a huge international media blitz involving politicians, religious figures from around the world, and victims' advocate groups all over the fate of Carla Faye Tucker. So is this a story of rehabilitation and redemption? Or is this the story of a very smart, calculated monster who was able to master a narrative that pulled the heartstrings of millions? And of course, the biggest question of all, if Carla Faye Tucker wasn't a young, pretty white woman, what kind of attention would have surrounded her sentencing and later execution? There's no question, however, that Carla Faye Tucker's crimes were gruesome and shocking. And we're going to get into those details in this episode, because I think it's important to know exactly what happened on the early morning of June 13th, 1983, to provide context for everything that came afterward. So I will provide sort of a warning here. This is going to be a little bit more grisly and gruesome than our typical episode. Likewise, I think this is also one of those cases where Carla's early life is also an important aspect of the story. Not to try to establish any sympathy for her, but to understand how her past was frequently cited to mitigate her later behaviors and the murders themselves.
Yeah, it should be a great episode. I'm really interested to get into it because I've always wanted to learn more about this case.
Yeah, it's a weird one for sure. First, before I get into it, let's cite our sources. So I pored over several court documents, including appeals documents for both criminal trials. There was an article for the New York Times entitled Execution in Texas, The Overview, published in 1998 by Sam Howe Verhovic. Two articles in the Houston Chronicle by Kathy Walt, published in 1997 and 1998. An article for the Chicago Tribune, published in 1998 by Cornelia Grumman. An LA Times article published in January of 1988 by Jesse Katz. The Texas Attorney General press release, which you can find a few different places online, including published in full on Murderpedia. And finally, the book, The Pickaxe Killers, by writer and criminologist R. Barry Flowers. Now, there are a lot of books out there about this case, and quite frankly, most of them have been criticized for some sort of hero worship involving Carla Faye Tucker, and often those books overlook the victims of this case. And as you all know, we're not down with that. Yeah. So that's why I chose to read this book in particular. And I thought it was a really good read. It is pretty short, but it really kept to the facts of the case without any romanticism. I, too, intend to stick to the facts and present all sides of this case. We're going to see it goes a little out of control, and there end up being a lot of voices clamoring to be heard. Carla Faye Tucker was born November 18, 1959, in Houston, Texas. Her father, Larry, was a longshoreman who worked in the Gulf of Mexico, and her mother, Carolyn, was a homemaker. The house was a strained one. The couple had some pretty serious marital problems, including infidelity, and perhaps the issues in their marriage took their attention away from their children, who all had early forays into bad behavior. According to Carla, she adored and admired her two older sisters, Kathy and Carrie, who often hung out with older kids and started dabbling in drugs at pretty young ages. When Carla was 10, her parents began a messy divorce, during which Carla discovered that Larry was not her biological father, and that she was in fact the product of an affair. Larry ended up with custody of the girls after the divorce, and by all accounts, he never treated Carla any differently than he did his natural children. But the girls all continued to get in trouble, with Larry either unwilling or unable to discipline them. By the age of 12, Carla was smoking pot, shooting heroin, and having sex.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty young to be doing all three of those things.
Exactly. At 14, Carla dropped out of school and moved in with her mother, Carolyn. Instead of the normal, healthy bonding experiences a young girl could have with her mother, Carolyn and Carla began doing heavy drugs and partying together. Carolyn was a rock groupie who followed bands like the Allman Brothers and the Eagles, and Carla was right there with her. Carla would later say about her relationship with her mother, quote, "We used to share drugs like lipstick."
Wow.
Carolyn also began sex work to support herself and not only introduced Carla to sex work, but actively encouraged her to do sex work. Carla was just 14.
That's awful.
And honestly, I'm not even sure if we can call that sex work because of her age. That's just statutory rape that her mother was enabling. So just from the bat, we've got a very bad situation for this young girl. At 16, Carla met Stephen Griffith, a 19-year-old mechanic. After a brief romance, the two married. Stephen would later recall that they had a rather violent relationship with frequent fistfights. He told the Houston Chronicle that Carla declared to him that one day she would be famous. But Carla wasn't ready to settle down into the married life, and it wasn't too long before the two separated. In her early 20s, Carla started hanging out with bikers and ended up meeting a woman named Sean Jackson. The two became fast friends, eventually moving in with each other. Sean soon introduced her to Daniel Ryan Garrett, nicknamed Danny, in 1981. Danny was a 35-year-old Vietnam vet, and Carla was only 21 when they began dating. Danny liked booze and drugs just as much as Carla did, so it was a match made in heaven. But things weren't always great between Carla and her friend and roommate, Sean. Sean was dating a man named Jerry Dean, who worked as the cable TV installer. Carla and Jerry, to put it mildly, did not get along. The mutual hatred they had for each other started the very first time they met, when Jerry parked his Harley Davidson motorcycle inside their apartment, dripping oil and spitting out fumes. You see, Jerry was damn proud of his motorcycle. He loved it, and he didn't want anything to happen to it if he parked it outside. When he refused to move the motorcycle, Carla punched him.
Okay, wow. So it seems like there's some evidence here that Carla is getting into situations where she's easily escalating to violence.
Oh, yes, and we are not done with that thread. So Carla hated Jerry, and despite her begging Sean to dump him, the two ended up getting married. On their wedding day, Carla moved out of the apartment and moved in with Danny in his house in a Houston neighborhood called Quay Point. Later, Carla's sister Carrie moved in, and Carrie's ex-husband Ronnie moved in later still. So we have a packed house. One day, Sean swung by to pick up some clothes of hers that she had left with Carla. When Carla found out that Jerry was outside waiting for Sean, she ran outside and punched him in the eye, shattering his glasses. He actually had to go to the hospital to get shards of glass removed from his eye.
Jeez.
There was pretty much no provocation for this assault either. Carla just heard he was outside and went out and punched him. For his part, Jerry would try to incite her wrath, constantly picking at her and telling Sean how much he hated her. He even told Sean not to hang out with Carla anymore, which Sean ignored. One day, Jerry found a picture of Carla and her mother, the only picture of the two that Carla owned. Jerry gleefully took a knife to the picture, stabbing both of the figures and destroying the photograph. Carla was furious when she found out, especially considering her mother had passed away just a couple years earlier. But Carla didn't just dislike Jerry for personal reasons. He was also abusive to Sean. At one point, Jerry punched Sean in the face, and Sean swore to break things off with him for good. She ended up moving in with Carla and Danny too. But this wasn't enough for Carla. She wanted to punish this man who had disrespected her so many times and who had hurt her friend Sean. And that's about the time that Carla began talking about getting revenge on Jerry. It started out simple enough. Sean had stolen Jerry's bank card when she had moved out, and she, Carla, and Carrie took large amounts of money out of the account. But that wasn't enough. The drugged-out friends began talking about stealing Jerry's prized motorcycle. Yeah, and maybe his car, too, a 1974 blue El Camino.
I might be biased, but that's a great vehicle. I had an 84 El Camino.
Oh, the year you were born, huh?
Mm-hmm.
It was during these talks when Danny first mentioned that if Jerry was around when they went to rob him, they'd have to kill him. And eventually, their talk morphed into an all-out fantasy to rob and murder Jerry Dean. Sean participated in the early chatter about stealing Jerry's motorcycle, but as the discussions grew darker, she refused to be involved. Sometime after Sean moved in with Carla and the others, she noticed some keys of hers were missing. You see, she still had a spare set of keys to the old apartment and to Jerry's El Camino. Unknown to Sean, Carla had discovered the keys and told Danny that she had them, but she never told Sean that she'd recovered them. About a week or two after Sean moved into the house, they threw a raging party filled with sex, booze, and drugs. It was the weekend of June 11th through the 12th, just before the murders. It was Carrie's birthday, and Saturday and Sunday, the house was filled with people and debauchery. And when I mentioned booze and drugs, I mean anything and everything and a whole lot of it. This included beer, tequila, rum, whiskey, marijuana, speed, heroin, cocaine, Valium, Dilaudids, and Percodan, both prescription painkillers, and Mandrax, which are basically Quaaludes.
Wow.
So you got your pick of whatever you want.
What a list. That sounds like a rock star party. Something you would see on like a documentary on the Behind the Music or something.
Yeah,
it's
does.
A lot of stuff.
It does. And that includes tons of people who came by to party that weekend, including a man named Jimmy LeBrant, a friend of Ronnie's. Remember, Ronnie was Carrie's ex-husband who happened to be living with her and the rest of them in this house.
Okay, yeah.
But by Sunday evening, most of the partygoers had filtered out, and Carla had driven Danny to a shift as a bartender. This left Carla and Jimmy, neither of whom were ready to say goodbye to their weekend high. Sean was there too, bouncing between extremes of seething anger towards Jerry and declarations of her undying love for him. As they continued doing drugs, Carla told Jimmy about how much she hated Jerry, and they joked about robbing him. At around 3 or 4 in the morning, Carla and Jimmy went to pick up Jerry from work. So to be clear, Danny has completed a whole shift of work while they've just sat around doing drugs together and talking about robbing Jerry. He went into work at around 6 or 7 at night, and it's now 3 or 4 in the morning. So Carla and Jimmy went to pick up Danny from work. They went back home, and they shot up speed together.
Oh boy. So now they're getting really amped.
Oh yeah. In fact, Jimmy started pacing around excitedly, telling Carla and Danny that he needed to do something, anything, or he would, quote, go crazy. Danny suggested that they finally do what they'd been talking about for so long, go to Jerry's apartment and steal his motorcycle and his El Camino. Danny drew out a diagram of the layout of the apartment for Jimmy. They changed clothes, dressing in all black, grabbed a shotgun, a .38 caliber revolver, and the three piled into Danny's Ford Ranchero pickup truck and headed to Jerry's place.
Man, a lot of car trucks involved with this.
Yeah, there really is.
The Ranchero and the El Camino are both part car, part truck. Huh.
Yeah, that's true. I actually looked up pictures of both. I mean, I knew what a El Camino was, but I looked up a Ranchero. And that's actually kind of important for the next phase of the story, that they had two pickup trucks.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
The three parked outside and split up to case the complex, Jimmy heading out to locate Jerry's El Camino, while Carla and Danny made sure no one was around. It was early morning, sometime between 4 and 6 a.m., and quiet. Danny met Carla at Jerry's door, and Carla unlocked it with Sean's misplaced keys. Danny and Carla crept inside the dark apartment. Jerry's Harley Davidson sat in the middle of the living room. Jerry had clearly been working on it, as it was partially disassembled and there were tools and parts strewn everywhere.
Just in the middle of the living room?
Yeah. Suddenly, they heard Jerry exclaim from one of the back rooms, "What's going on?" Without a word, Carla and Danny walked into the apartment's spare bedroom and found Jerry sitting on a mattress on the floor. At the side of the room, propped up against the wall, was a ball-peen hammer and a 3-foot-long, 15-pound pickaxe. Carla walked up to Jerry and sat in his lap. Jerry was scared, and it thrilled Carla to see him that way. "We can work it out," Jerry said, apparently referring to the money that had been stolen from his bank account. Carla told him to shut up and then pounced on him. Jerry grabbed her arms and Danny pushed them apart, knocking Carla to the ground in the process. Carla got to her feet and turned to see Danny with the ball-peen hammer in his hands. As she watched, Danny slammed the hammer into the back of Jerry's head multiple times. Carla turned on the light in the room and saw Jerry face down on the mattress. Danny turned and walked out of the room and began packing up motorcycle equipment and other items of value from Jerry's apartment. Carla was now alone with Jerry's body, except Jerry wasn't dead. He began to make gurgling noises. Carla lifted the pickaxe up and brought the blade down on Jerry's body. She hit him over and over and over again, but Jerry kept making the gurgling sound. From the hallway, Jimmy heard Jerry's struggling noises, which he described as, quote, like an aquarium pump that was broken. He looked into the bedroom to see Carla with her foot propped up on Jerry's body, trying to get leverage to pull the pickaxe from where it was embedded inside of him. Jerry would later describe the scene, quote, "She finally got the axe out, got it up over her head, turned and looked at me and smiled, and hit the dude again." Horrified, Jimmy fled the apartment on foot. Danny walked back into the room and Carla told him to make the noise stop. Danny took the pickaxe from her and hit Jerry once more in the chest, and finally there was silence. He once again left the room. That's when Carla noticed movement under the covers next to Jerry's body. Carla poked at the spot with the pickaxe, and a woman emerged from under the sheets. Her name was Deborah Thornton, and no one had known she was going to be there that night. In fact, the 32-year-old office worker herself probably hadn't expected to be there either. You see, Deborah was married to a man named Richard Thornton. They'd had a fight and Deborah had stormed out of the house. She'd ended up going to a party the day before where she had met Jerry. She had ended up going home with him.
So she's just been under the covers listening to all this the whole time?
Yes, and trying to hide. Deborah began wrestling with Carla. Danny walked back into the room to see them struggling and futilely tried to come between them. Carla took this opportunity to bring the pickaxe down into Deborah's shoulder. Carla and Jerry took a second to discuss what they should do with Deborah. They decided that since she had heard their voices, heard their names, and seen their faces, they would have to kill her. With the pickaxe still in her shoulder, Deborah cried out, "Oh God, it hurts. If you're going to kill me, please hurry up." Danny walked over to her and kicked her in the head. He pulled the pickaxe from her shoulder and swung it down on her, hitting her in the throat. Carla then took the pickaxe and hit Deborah herself many times. Danny and Carla went into the living room and together they carried the motorcycle frame outside and loaded it into Jerry's El Camino. Using the keys she had taken from Sean, Carla drove to Danny's brother's house, a man by the name of Doug. Upon arriving, she told Doug that she and Danny had killed Jerry and asked him to help her carry the motorcycle frame into his garage. She handed Jerry's wallet to Doug, who burned it in an ashtray. Soon, Danny showed up at his brother's house with Jimmy and Ronnie. After leaving the murder scene, Jimmy had walked around town aimlessly until finally calling Ronnie to get a ride home. Danny had swung by his house and found him there. At first, Danny was furious for Jimmy for running away, but Jimmy promised to make it up to him by helping out in the aftermath of the crime. Danny's brother Doug at first refused to allow them to store the motorcycle parts in his garage, but soon relented. They unloaded the boxes stolen from Jerry's apartment and the four left in Danny's truck. Later, Jimmy abandoned the El Camino and a parking lot near the Astrodome.
Wow. This is a lot of people really quick to be okay and participate and help with a murder and a robbery.
It really is. And I think that has a lot to do with the drug addledness of a lot of these people who are involved. We're going to see some humanity creep into some of these people who are in play right now. At around 6:40 in the morning, just hours or even minutes after the slaying, Jerry Dean's friend and coworker Gregory was waiting for Jerry to come pick him up. Gregory lived near Jerry and they would carpool to work together every morning. When Jerry didn't arrive by 6:50, Gregory decided to walk over to Jerry's apartment. He knocked on the door but didn't receive a response. He discovered the front door was unlocked, so he let himself in. He immediately noticed that things in the apartment looked odd. Jerry's motorcycle was gone, the TV had been moved to the floor, and the radio was turned up loud. Gregory moved into the spare bedroom and found Jerry lying on a mattress. He saw blood and told investigators that his first thought was that Jerry must have gotten into some sort of fight. But then he saw the massive amount of blood around his head and the gouges in Jerry's chest. He would later remark that Jerry's body, quote, looked like he had been butchered. Deborah's body lay on the floor next to the mattress, also covered in blood. The pickaxe had been left behind, still lodged in her chest.
Holy crap, man. I always feel really bad for people who discover brutal crime scenes like this. You know,
it has to be just the worst.
Yeah, and there's fans of true crime. They're like, oh, I'd love to find a dead body or whatever. No, you wouldn't.
No.
This would be so traumatic and just ingrained in your mind forever and nightmarish.
Absolutely. And I haven't seen the crime scene photos of this particular scene. I don't know if they're even out there. Usually, even if you're not looking for them, you'll come across them. Yeah. I have not in any way. But from what a lot of people said about this scene, it was horrific. The state of the bodies, the blood everywhere. It was just nightmarish.
Pickaxe. That is a terrible way to go.
Yeah. Gregory ran from the apartment and called the authorities. 27-year-old Jerry Dean had been struck with the pickaxe 28 times, and an estimated 20 of those by themselves would have been fatal. His skull had also been fractured from the blows from the ball-peen hammer. Deborah Thornton, 32, also had at least 20 puncture wounds in her back and chest from the pickaxe. Jerry's motorcycle, various motorcycle parts, Jerry's El Camino, and both Jerry and Deborah's wallets were all missing from the scene. Deborah's husband, Richard Thornton, was at home with their daughter when police came to tell him of Deborah's murder. According to his essay on the website murdervictims.com, he sat staring at the ceiling fan for ages, in shock, willing his wife to call him to tell him she was okay and that it was all a big misunderstanding. Instead, the news came on the TV, and Richard heard of the double homicide by pickaxe and saw the bodies draped with sheets. But it wasn't until the program aired pictures of Deborah's pickup truck outside the residence that he fully realized that it was his wife's violent murder that was being reported.
That's like the worst news to ever get.
It's really, really brutal, especially considering that, and I don't mean this with any disrespect to Deborah herself, but knowing that she was found in another man's bed.
Yeah.
I can't imagine.
There's a lot of mixed emotions going on.
Absolutely.
Through his head.
Yeah. I mean, I just can't imagine how just horrible this whole situation was for everybody involved. But Richard wasn't the only one who caught the early news reports being broadcast about the vicious murders that morning. Carla and Danny were watching too. They howled with laughter about what they had done, giddy that they were famous, and called each other the pickaxe killers. When Carla told Carrie about the murders, she gave Carrie Deborah's wallet, telling her it was her birthday present. Carrie was disgusted and horrified. She threw it away and she moved out of the house immediately that same day, scared for her own safety.
Yeah, who wouldn't be?
And strangely enough, she actually ended up moving in with Doug, Danny's brother.
Who's helping with the crime, to some degree.
Who I think is confused and doesn't know what to do and is just trying to handle a situation that he is stunned by at this point.
Wow, this is a crazy group of friends.
Yes.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby. Mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa. Take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Ch-ch-chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Over the next weeks, Carla and Danny bragged about the murders and even talked about killing more people. They breathlessly described how they would start raiding drug labs, killing everyone inside, and taking the drugs and money for themselves. Carrie even overheard them talking about killing Jimmy and Ronnie to help keep them from talking about the murders. But the fact was, Carla and Danny were the ones boasting about the murders in minute detail to just about everyone, it seemed like. And according to Carrie and Doug, Carla admitted to what might be one of the biggest bombshells of this story. That every time she had swung the pickaxe down on her victims, she had orgasmed.
Oh yeah, I remember this weird part of this case. Such a strange detail.
Yeah, well, the reason why this was such a shock to people is that this was a woman declaring that she felt sexual pleasure during murder. That's frequently something we hear in cases involving male serial killers, the sexual gratification of the violence inflicted on others. But it's rarely something that is attributed to female murderers or even female serial killers. It's almost never identified as a motivation for or symptom of the act of murder by women. Now, to be clear, Carla would later vehemently deny that she had gotten sexual pleasure from the murders. But at least two people later testified that she explicitly told them this.
Well, and I could see why she would later deny it, too, because that is a thing that can be used to show that you're going to be a continued danger to society.
Bingo.
Yeah, and you can get capital punishment for that kind of thing.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Interesting. And it's also something weird to brag about to someone. That's just strange.
If it isn't true, it's a weird thing to even come up in your head.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what to think about it. There's obviously no way we can prove it one way or the other.
And every time she swung the pickaxe, that's a lot.
Those were her comments, according to Carrie and Doug.
I mean, she was already terrifying enough before adding that detail.
Yeah, exactly. And Carla would later admit that at the time, she also felt no guilt, no remorse for what she had done, and in fact had felt proud that she had, quote, finally measured up to the big boys. Sometime after the murders, Doug began feeling tremendous guilt about his knowledge about the slayings of Jerry Dean and Deborah Thornton. He removed the motorcycle parts Carla and Danny had left in his garage, throwing them into the Brazos River. Doug then contacted family friend J.C. Mosier, who happened to be a homicide detective. He told Detective Mosier that Jimmy Liebrandt had something to do with the pickaxe murders, but initially didn't go into further detail. Soon, though, Doug disclosed the entire story and helped investigators recover some of the motorcycle parts he had thrown in the river. Carrie, too, agreed to work with investigators.
Well, that's good that we at least have two individuals that are coming around, but man, don't destroy evidence. Luckily, they were able to find some of it, though, which is good.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. I don't know if he chose to do that before he decided to go to the authorities or after.
It sounds like he was scared and felt guilty at the same time.
I think that's definitely accurate. Since Carla and Danny had been so forthcoming before, investigators asked Doug to wear a wire to see if they could record them talking candidly about the slayings. Doug agreed, and it didn't take long for investigators to get about 2 full hours of conversation of the two describing the events in detail. Now, again, I do not have a copy of this recording. I do not think it is available, But from what I've heard, this recording has Carla talking about the sexual pleasure she experienced during the murders. But I cannot really confirm or deny that because I don't have the recording. I don't have a transcript of the recording or anything. But I have heard some sources say that.
Okay. But it obviously has some really damning admissions to the killings themselves.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was apparently full detail, no question about it. Mm. Carla Faye Tucker and Danny Garrett were arrested on July 20th, just 17 days after the double homicide. Jimmy and Ronnie were also arrested for their roles, although they ended up never being charged. In September of 1983, Carla and Danny were both indicted for murder in the course of committing and attempting to commit a robbery. The fact that the murders occurred during a robbery meant that the crimes were capital. They were set to be tried separately the following year. Carla's capital murder trial began March 2, 1984 in Harris County with a jury of 8 women and 4 men. She pled not guilty to the charges, even though at this point she had fully confessed to the crimes. She would later contend that she only pled not guilty at the prodding of her defense team. Evidence used against her included eyewitness testimony from Jimmy, Ronnie, Carrie, and Doug, who together were able to fill in pretty much all details of the crime, and the recording of her and Danny speaking about the murders.
So just to be clear, she initially pled guilty, but then changed her plea to not guilty? Is that what happened?
No, she fully confessed to her role in the murder by the time the trial started, but she still ended up pleading not guilty.
Oh,
okay. Later, she says, well, the only reason why I pled not guilty is because my lawyers told me to.
Okay.
So I think, again, it was an attempt for her to kind of get sympathy.
Okay.
Or perhaps after the fact to suggest, well, if I had pled guilty, maybe I wouldn't have gotten a certain punishment. Yeah.
Which I'm guessing we're going to get into.
Oh, absolutely.
All right.
The defense called no witnesses of its own and mostly focused on the amount of drugs and alcohol Carla had ingested leading up to the early morning of June 13th. It took the jury just 1 hour to find Carla guilty of capital murder on April 19th.
Even that long is surprising.
Yeah. Well, that's basically long enough to, like, sign the paperwork. The sentencing phase began shortly thereafter. The defense called a psychiatrist who testified about Carla's upbringing, her drug and alcohol addiction, and her presumed state of mind during the murders. She also claimed that she found it, quote, unlikely that Carla had achieved sexual gratification from the murders. Carla herself took the stand as well and testified, quote, I did not see the bodies. I do not remember seeing any holes or any blood.
I don't believe you.
Yeah. Well, neither did the jury, because after just 3 hours of deliberation, Carla was sentenced to death. She was transferred to the Mountain View unit in Gatesville to serve her time on death row. Her friend and roommate was Pam Perillo, whose case we covered way back in episode 4 of this podcast.
Old Pam Perillo from the Two Bobs episode.
That's right. Danny's trial began in September of 1984. Carla testified against Danny, becoming the state's star witness. For this role, Carla's murder charge for the death of Deborah Thornton was dropped, despite the fact that Carla had already been convicted. Prosecutors did not charge Danny for Deborah's murder either, meaning that officially no one was ever tried or convicted for the brutal and terrifying murder of Deborah Thornton. Now, I know that's weird.
That is unbelievable.
It is unbelievable, so much so that I was like, I have to have that wrong. But as far as I understand it, that's what happened. Because from my research, I saw that the charges were officially dropped on November 2nd, 1984. That's after Carla's trial was already over. Mm-hmm. So how you drop charges for a trial that you'd already convicted a person on is something that I do not understand. So if anybody out there can explain that to us, or is it possible that I have that wrong? I don't understand how that is even legally a possibility.
And it also doesn't make any sense. If that's part of a bargain that Carla's getting to participate in being the lead witness against Danny in his trial, Like, if that's something that they offered her, like, oh, we'll vacate your charges on this one case, she's still got the death penalty for the other murder. So what does it matter to her?
That's a very good point. I mean, it doesn't.
And it's shameful because then what about Deborah's family?
They don't really get justice, I mean, on paper, because nobody's actually convicted for her murder.
Right.
Well, later in November, Danny was also found guilty of the murder of Jerry Dean and was sentenced to death. Now, years later in 1993, Danny was awarded a new trial by the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals because of improper jury selection. However, just 6 months later, Danny Garrett died in prison of cirrhosis of the liver.
Man, that gets a lot of criminals, doesn't it? I mean, this is like the fourth one that's died in prison from cirrhosis of the liver that we've covered on the show. Is it just like prison booze?
I mean,
like toilet hooch that's getting him?
I guess that's a possibility. Obviously, we know his lifestyle before all of this, before sure. he ever went to prison.
Maybe his liver was just toast by the time he got in.
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't very old at all. He was only 37 at the time of the murders, and this was only about 10 years later. So he was about 47 when he died.
Wow.
So because of that, we have no idea what potentially new information could have come from that trial. I mean, yeah, we don't know.
That would have been interesting.
Yeah. So what happened next really came about from something that happened back in October of 1984, when Carla was in prison awaiting trial. And this would drastically change the atmosphere and direction of this entire story. Carla attended a ministry program being held at the prison and stole a Bible, not realizing that the Bibles were provided to the prisoners free of charge. She claimed that she began reading the Bible and shortly thereafter dropped to her knees and began to pray. Quote, "I didn't know what I was reading. Before I knew it, I was in the middle of my cell floor on my knees. I was just asking God to forgive me." From that moment forward, Carla contended that she had become a born-again Christian, eager to serve the Lord. Carla had already been a major news story by this point. A woman slinging a pickaxe and brutally murdering two people and then admitting that she had gotten sexual pleasure from it, that's all big news. But Carla's conversion to Christianity and her newfound devotion to God just months after the horrific slayings was newsworthy in of itself. And Carla Faye Tucker became the face of the anti-death penalty movement. She was pretty, petite, white, articulate, and by all accounts, sweet. She became a lightning rod, humanizing death row prisoners while simultaneously having very little in common with the vast majority of death row prisoners. And she was a good interview, giving great sound bites for every news organization, magazine, and newspaper around the world. Carla pushed for multiple appeals over the next 14 years on death row, all the while giving interviews to Larry King, the 700 Club, and numerous others regarding the fact that she was now reformed, devoted to God, and that she would do more good alive than dead. She also said that she was a model prisoner, a sentiment that even the prison warden himself agreed with, and that she wanted to help other prisoners who had once been like her. She argued that she was no longer a threat to society. She compared the death penalty to abortion and euthanasia, things that Carla reasoned all Christians should be opposed to. Of course, Carla denied certain things too, things that are impossible to prove one way or another. She vehemently denied receiving sexual pleasure from the killings. She also denied that the murders were premeditated in any way, saying that she did not go to the apartment that night intending on killing Jerry Dean. Politicians and public figures flocked to her cause. Pope John Paul II and Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich publicly spoke in support of her appeals for clemency. Televangelist Pat Robertson, usually a proponent of the death penalty, also threw his support behind her. Human rights activist Bianca Jagger, the United Nations Commissioner on Summary and Arbitrary Executions, Bakre Wale Ndiaye, Italian Prime Minister Romano Prodi, the ACLU. The list goes on and on and on. Wow. Of the people insisting that Carla receive clemency and for her sentence to be commuted to life in prison.
To have the Pope name you specifically and be against your death is pretty out there.
Well, I mean, this is really symptomatic of how much of a media sensation this became, how much mm-hmm. of a worldwide discussion Carla Faye Tucker became to people.
Yeah, you had the Speaker of the House also.
Like. Yeah, absolutely. Everybody had an opinion on it, one way or the other. Perhaps most importantly, Deborah Thornton's brother, Ron Carlson, also eventually joined her cause. At first, he supported Carla and Danny's death sentences, saying, quote, "I think they got what they deserved." But later, Ron would take a dramatic shift in the way he viewed Carla and the death penalty as a whole, eventually campaigning strongly for Carla's clemency, even lobbying at the state capitol in Austin on her behalf. But not everyone was on board with this starry-eyed view of Carla. Diane Clements, the president of the victims' rights group, Justice for All, addressed the tide of support by saying, quote, "There is a public campaign to spare the life of Carla Faye Tucker. This campaign is based on fraud, lies, ignorance, and sexism. Richard Thornton, husband of Deborah, and member of Justice for All, was also in favor of Carla's original sentence." Critics of Carla and the cult of personality surrounding her pointed out that, on one hand, she had said all the right things, that she was sorry, that if God wanted her to be executed, then she accepted that fate, yet she fought tooth and nail for every appeal and every media appearance that she could get her hands on over the years, forcing her victims' families to go through appeal after appeal and see her face plastered all over the news, constantly talking about what a good person she was. But more to the point, victims' advocates pointed out that in all of Carla's media appearances and interviews, she rarely actually mentioned her victims by name, and they questioned whether or not she was truly this reformed Christian who wanted to live to serve God, or if she was just manipulating the system to get sympathy and thus a lighter sentence.
Yeah. Yeah. What if she really is a psychopath that is twisting everybody around her little finger?
Yeah. And I think ultimately that is a very good question. I do not have the answer to it. I mean, I think that's just based on your opinion, you know? So in a nutshell, I think what we're seeing in the aftermath of Carla Faye Tucker's conviction and the media circus surrounding her appeals for clemency are a lot of politicians and activists and organizations who are outspoken opponents of the death penalty already, who use this opportunity to throw their support behind Carla, perhaps not for Carla as a person, but as a symbol of the anti-death penalty movement that was taking over the global conversation because of this case.
Yeah.
So that's people like the ACLU, the Pope, etc. Then they were joined by people who typically are for the death penalty, but who also took this as an opportunity to support a pro-Christian message. And that's people like televangelist Pat Robertson. Then, of course, you have people and groups who were for the death penalty, at the very least in Carla's case, and who argued that she was receiving special treatment that other death row inmates rarely, if ever, receive because she was a white woman.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point.
In 1995, Carla Faye Tucker married the prison's chaplain, Reverend Dana Brown, in a Christian ceremony held in the prison between a pane of glass. Because of her status on death row, the couple never consummated their marriage, never kissed, never held hands, but Dana continued to be a strong support system for Carla while she was in prison.
That's astounding.
I agree.
Okay. I don't get prison relationships that develop.
No, not in a million years. I don't.
No, especially a prison chaplain who works on death row.
Yeah. There's a very weird power imbalance there that also makes me uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So, but I don't know. I tried actually looking for more information about Reverend Dana Brown and just, you know, like kind of
what happened to him? Well,
yeah, what happened to him? And I couldn't find any additional information really on him. So,
weird.
Yeah, and I couldn't really find much information about their relationship either, except that they seemed to truly care about each other. So, yeah. Well, you know, we could go over all of the appeals, all the maneuvering that Carla's legal team did to help her cause, but it would take a very, very long time. In summary, everything was tried and nothing bore fruit, although over the years, she twice had an execution date set that was then later stayed. Finally, in December of 1997, the U.S. Supreme Court rejected Carla's petition to have her case reviewed, and she received her final execution date, February 3rd, 1998. The next couple of months were a flurry of activity for Carla's legal team, who tried everything in their power to be granted another stay of execution. On January 20th, her team asked that the execution date be postponed so they could put together an argument citing that the Texas clemency process was unconstitutionally vague. However, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals refused the postponement, declaring that the clemency process should be handled by the executive branch, not by the court system. On January 22nd, she appealed to the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles, asking for her sentence to be commuted to life in prison. On February 2nd, the day before her scheduled execution, the board voted to reject her petition. The same day, January 22nd, Carla petitioned then-Governor George W. Bush to delay her execution. And what do we know about Governor Bush and his history with the death penalty in Texas?
That he executed the most people as governor of Texas?
Well, not personally.
Yeah, right.
But he oversaw the most executions in Texas history up to that point.
Yeah,
Rick Perry later blew his number out of the water.
Right.
So that number under George Bush was 155 executions. He only granted clemency to one. Can you name that single lucky individual?
No.
It was Henry Lee Lucas.
Really?
That's correct.
Was that early on in his governor days?
I believe it was around the same time as this. I think it was in 1998, if I'm not wrong. Yeah.
I forgot Henry Lee Lucas was around that long.
And that's actually a really fascinating story in of itself. And if you're wondering, yes, I'm sure one day we will cover that particular disgusting pile of garbage one day as well.
Yeah.
So George W. Bush refused to grant Carla's request for a stay of execution. On the 2nd of February, Carla was flown to the state penitentiary in Huntsville in preparation for her execution. Outside, more than 1,000 protesters and supporters showed up at the Huntsville unit. Some carried signs reading, "Axe and ye shall receive."
Oh, wow.
"Execution is not a solution. No one executed has ever committed another crime." And, "Jesus was a victim of the death penalty." Others sang gospel and prayed. Over 200 reporters from around the world gathered, hungry to be the first to break any news. And then finally, Carla Faye Tucker's execution date arrived. Her final meal was a banana, a peach, and a garden salad with ranch dressing. Present for the execution were Dana Brown, Carla's husband, her sister Carrie, her friend Jackie, and her lawyer. Victims' relatives included Deborah Thornton's husband Richard, their son, and her stepdaughter. They watched from a separate viewing room saved for victims' families. Deborah's brother, Ron Carlson, was also there, but in support of Carla. He did not watch with the victim's family. He watched with the members that were there in support of Carla. And according to the book, The Pickaxe Killers, quote, "This was the first known instance where a member of a victim's family witnessed an execution on behalf of the murderer."
Wow. Now, you said Chaplain Dana was there. He didn't act as the chaplain in the actual execution, did he?
No, he was not in the room.
Okay, because that would have been weird.
Yeah, in the actual execution chamber, he was not there, no. He watched with the family as a role of the husband would.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Good. So I was like, man, that is a big conflict of interest there.
Yeah, that would be very strange. Carla Faye Tucker's final words were, quote, "Yes, sir, I would like to say to all of you, the Thornton family and Jerry Dean's family, that I am so sorry. I hope God will give you peace with this. Baby, I love you. Ron, give Peggy a hug for me. Everybody has been so good to me. I love all of you very much. I'm going to be face to face with Jesus now. Thank all of you so much. You've all been so good to me. I love you all very much. I will see you all when you get there. I will wait for you." Carla Faye Tucker was executed by lethal injection and pronounced dead at 6:45 p.m. on February 3rd, 1998. After she died, a reporter for KTRK-TV in Houston quoted Richard Thornton as saying softly, "Here she comes, baby doll. She's all yours. The world's a better place." Carla Faye Tucker was the first woman to be executed in the state of Texas since 1863, when Chipita Rodriguez was hanged for murder. And I'm thinking that might be a very interesting future episode.
Oh, yeah. I've looked into that case a little bit. And I was curious if you were going to bring her up, because that is like another one of the really astounding facts in this case, is how long it took for us to execute another woman.
Yeah. And since Carla Faye Tucker, there have been several I think between 5 and 10, I want to say. I don't know the exact number, but it's been...
And a few that have come really close.
Yeah, absolutely.
That have, like, somehow been able to get off of death row. Which...
Yeah. After the execution was over, Richard Thornton spoke to reporters saying, quote, "I want to say to every victim in the world, demand this. This is your right. 14 and a half years ago, Carla Faye Tucker exploded my family. 14 and a half years later, she brought my family back together. She finally said my wife's name. It took her 14 and a half years to do it. We'll begin tomorrow without the name Carla Faye Tucker stuck in her face every day." End quote.
That's a pretty good statement.
Yeah. Those opposed to the execution and to the death penalty in general lamented that this case proved that the Texas judicial system has no path to clemency and doesn't allow for redemption for past crimes. Carla's attorney, David Botsford, released a statement, quote, "Texas has no mercy. The clemency process in this state is a farce. Rehabilitation, religious conversion, that's meaningless in this state."
So, yeah, all this was really fascinating. It makes me want to ask questions about Pam Perillo again from episode 4. A lot of the things that Carla Faye Tucker took and stances that she made in her case for her appeals, you know, the being a born-again Christian and doing all these interviews, very similar to what Pam did.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Carla probably had a lot to do with that.
Yeah.
And ultimately, Pam, her sentence was commuted, as we talked about in that episode. If you haven't listened to it, go do that.
Yeah. So it worked for Pam.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm not going to inject my opinion about this case, about whether or not Carla Faye Tucker should have been executed, because I don't really know what that is. You know, I really hoped for this episode I could present a story that really kind of told you all sides of the story. So I hope I was able to bring that to you. I was trying not to editorialize too much or really insert my own opinions. I think this is one of those cases where you stand on it, it ultimately just depends on how you feel about the death penalty itself and how you look at redemption or mercy. If somebody kills somebody, especially in this brutal, heinous way, can they ever do good? Or are they always that same person who is deserving of this just punishment? And I think that's a question that, you know, I can't answer it. I mean, I think everybody individually sort of has to go through that thought process of what, you know, what does this mean to me?
Yeah, and I don't think it's as black and white as a lot of people try and make it out to be.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I can see positives in kind of both sides.
Yeah, there's lots of shades of gray in there. And also, I think if we could learn a little bit more about the truth of who Carla Faye Tucker actually was and what she was thinking and what actually happened that night, we would get a little more insight into, did she actually deserve the death penalty ultimately in the end?
Yeah, and that's why I really wanted to include those details, even though they're so horrific and hard to listen to. So much of the cult of personality that is built around Carla Faye Tucker really brushes those details under the rug. And I don't think that's fair to the victims about what happened. I think we have to really think about what happened that night and what kind of person it would take to do those things, not only that night, but also in the weeks afterward.
Yeah. And is someone like that able to be rehabilitated?
Yeah.
Which is a valid question, I feel, and is something that I don't know if our justice system has ever answered for us.
No, but it's a really good question. I would like to say yes, but I don't know. I mean, and so ultimately that's kind of, you know, like I said, it's up to the listener how you know, what your personal views are on this. And it's not a black and white issue. It's incredibly nuanced. So,
but I would love to hear y'all's feedback on the ACNC Posse discussion page on Facebook.
Yeah. I mean, you know, be calm about it. Respect people's opinions. Yeah.
And be nice.
Yeah. So this was a very interesting case to really get into. So I hope I did it justice. There was just so much to cover. But again, thank you so much to Mel T, who sponsored this episode and who chose this topic. I'm really glad I was able to put this out for you. I hope that everybody kind of learned something and, you know, have a lot to think about maybe.
Yeah. Thank you, Mel T. We really appreciate all the support from our awesome patrons that help us put out episodes like this.
That's right. With no further ado, I believe it is time for good news, finally.
All right. We'll have some good news right after this.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
So this week I have a good news story for you, Aaron. It comes from ABC 13 Eyewitness News, and it's an article that was written by Nick Tario on July 3rd. So pretty recently this story happened. Just about a week and a half ago, actually, a few miles north of Houston, the home of Montgomery County Constable Brian Dubois burned to the ground.
Oh no.
Yeah.
It's... Some of these good news stories do not start out well.
It always seems like it's mine. On the night of the fire, he and his wife had been sound asleep. The only reason they actually woke up in time to escape was due to their trusty rescue dog named Xena.
The warrior princess?
Yes, the same. And it's actually spelled with an X.
And it's a rescue dog? What kind of dog?
It's a rescue dog. It's a German Shepherd.
Oh my good gravy.
We almost named our crested gecko that we just got Xena. That was in the running.
You know, not to insert myself too much into the story, but I want everybody to know that Xena was my absolute favorite growing up. I watched it constantly. I've always wanted to be Xena for Halloween. One day I will do it.
Have we talked about the birthday cake I got you that had a picture of Xena on it holding her chakram with a burning village behind it?
It was pretty amazing.
Yeah, and Lucy Lawless is super beautiful.
Right? Yeah, she's very cool.
She's in my all-time top five.
All right.
According to Brian, though, Brian Dubois, the county constable, getting back to the story, Xena broke out of her kennel where she sleeps at night and woke the family up.
Wow.
Yeah, so as soon as Brian awoke to his dog barking and yelling and running around the room, and also being like, how did you get out of your kennel?
Did you think she did one of those flying, spinning kicks?
Oh, like Xena?
Uh-huh.
And went, ay, 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 ay. As soon as he woke up, his eyes started burning. And like he noticed that smoke was filling the air and it was hard to breathe. And so immediately he grabbed his wife and they started heading out. And he said, quote, fire just boiled out from everywhere. It had been burning for a while, end quote. Luckily, the three of them were narrowly able to escape the home just in time to see the flames engulf the majority of the structure. For the following 30 minutes, local firefighters arrived and battled this blaze. Unfortunately, most of the home was burned beyond repair. After everything was over, Brian did tell ABC 13 Eyewitness News that Xena had saved their lives. A year earlier, Brian fell in love with Xena when she was an undersized German Shepherd at the local animal shelter. Yeah, he said, quote, I went and got her and she weighed like 35 pounds. She had just about every bug you could think of, internal parasites, everything. After some medical treatment, good food, and plenty of time with her loving family in her forever home, well, I guess not so forever home, maybe a new home after that.
Yeah.
Xena then weighed a whopping 85 pounds.
Oh, wow.
So she put on like 50 pounds of weight.
Yeah.
But Brian also said, quote, there's no doubt about it. She returned the favor that we gave her tenfold that night. Currently, the family is staying at an extended stay hotel in Conroe, but local community members have already raised over $5,000 via a Facebook page to help the family recover from their loss. They do have home insurance, but of course, this will not be enough to cover everything, all of their expenses, and the lost items. And about the fundraiser, Brian said, quote, "The public outpour and the people that have contacted us, I couldn't ask for any more of God's grace," end quote. And I will be sure to share the Facebook fundraiser page on all of our social media if anyone wants to help them reach their goal of $10,000. And the Dubois family is hoping to use some of that money that they get from their goal to afford an RV that they can live in on their property while they wait for their home to be rebuilt. And of course, there will be a special place in that RV for the warrior princess, Xena. And lastly, the local fire marshal later cited a faulty surge protector as the culprit for starting the fire, which I know, and also scary because, like, we have a bunch of surge protectors, and which one of you are faulty?
Oh, I know, especially because we buy, like, the cheapest one you can possibly get.
I know, they have, like, surge protectors that are, like, $100. Yeah. It's like, we're not getting that.
No, ma'am.
But I don't know, maybe if it burns our house down, do we need $100 surge protectors?
Probably.
Okay. Oh, man. Well, that's good news.
That was incredible. I actually did get misty-eyed. Like, when you were talking about how, you know, he saved her life and then she turned around and saved theirs and that. Yeah. Listen, we do not deserve dogs.
We don't.
That's a fact of life. They're the absolute best. They just provide so much wonderful happiness, except for when your dog named Nelson, who was a little Shih Tzu, is being a huge turd during recording time. And I'm looking at you right now because you have been. But usually they're just excellent. And I love Xena, the warrior princess, and the warrior dog. Just a great story. I loved it. Thank you.
Yeah, the rescue that becomes the rescuer.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, it's been a long episode, so we're not going to be doing our usual recommendations in the after show, but welcome to the after show, everyone. And what we do need to do, though, is we need to give some props and shout outs. And, you know, we need to get some deputies shouted out, but first, we got to do those Texas Rangers. So at the top of the list of our Texas Rangers is the one that helped produce this episode, Mel T.
Mel T, what's up?
That's right. The T stands for...
Terrific.
Yes. Mel Terrific. Next up is the ever-present first of her kind, Lisa Layton.
Lisa is awesome.
She sure is. And then Matthew McConnell, Steph White, Serial Killer Sweets, Michelle Guess, Andrew Margerison, Kate Williams, and Don Maloney. Thank y'all. You are all awesome, and we hope to be doing more of these episodes and getting more episodes out that you guys can help produce and choose topics. So thank you so much.
Yeah, that's a good point. We actually have another one coming up that you're going to be doing.
Yep.
And so we're going to be contacting some more of you. The way this kind of works, I don't know if we've really described how it works, but it's basically in order of...
When you became a Texas Ranger.
Yeah, it's like first come, first served. You don't have to continue upping your donation if you do not want to. It's kind of like if you donate once, you're on the list and we're going to get to you eventually. Yeah. Obviously, we're a bit behind. You know, we're doing our best. Obviously, we try to make these the kind of bigger episodes, the ones that have a lot of research usually. So
that's right.
So, but thank you guys so much. We love you.
We certainly do love you guys. But we got to pay some homage to the other side of our Patreon tier. That's the deputies. And I'm going to run through those real quick. So thank you so much to Erica Kelly from Southern Fried True Crime.
Yeah.
Tina Frost, Kathy Rambo, Anita Mitchell, Megan Lundgren, the Murder in My Family podcast.
Oh, I feel like I've done that every time.
It's always surprising that Morph is so supportive. Oh my God. Yeah. Thank you, Morph. Kelly Roberts, Gracie Bosch, Danielle Dole, Kristen Buford, Amy Davidson, the Murder and Such podcast, which we're going to be hanging out with in Chicago.
Oh, yeah.
Like now. We should be having beers with them right now, this minute, when you're listening to it.
I can only hope.
Yeah.
Gosh.
Lillian, Cassie Colomer, Leslie De La Paz, Marianne Connor, Brittany, Moms and Murder Podcast, The Corpus Delicti Podcast, Karen Parker, True Crime Fan Club Podcast, Elena Baker, A.R. Feutzwaggle, Angela Johnson, Jessica M. O'Neill, Donald Brown, Juliana Martinez, and Carrie Simonton. Thank you guys so much, deputies. We have an army of deputies now.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Go out there and arrest people for littering and...
Well, you just got to pull up your phone and show them the ad-free listening that you're listening to. And, like, that's my badge right there. Is our logo.
You can't legally do that.
No. You can't.
I'm like, I'm such a lawyer, Shay. I've been researching all of this legal stuff, and I felt like I needed to be clear that we can't actually tell you doing that, if you were wondering.
Yeah, Angela Johnson, don't go try and stop an altercation and in public.
No.
With your podcast on your
or at
phone.
Least don't have us have anything to do with it.
Yeah.
Okay. What's up next?
That's it. That's our show.
Oh, good golly. Hey, well, I hope that we're having a really great time in Chicago right now.
Yeah.
And
we're probably going to be jet lagged as hell because mm-hmm. we stayed up late mm-hmm. producing a show mm-hmm. because we love you guys mm-hmm. and packing all of this merch together to give to people that come to see us.
Oh, God. And speaking of which, we need to get out of here.
Yeah.
So thank you guys so much again. Thank you, Mel T. And we will see you next week.
That's right. Always remember, the crime is bigger in Texas, y'all. Adios.
Bye.